Good afternoon or good morning for those of you in the West. Welcome to the Talking Freight Seminar Series. My name is Nicole Cooney and I will moderate today's seminar. Today's topic is freight shipments and the changing last mile. Before I go any further, I want to mention that we have been experiencing connectivity issues with Adobe Connect. DOT is working to resolve this issue. However, a permanent fix is not yet in place. If you begin to experience poor audio quality while listening to this webinar via your computer, the best solution is to call the teleconference line. If the computer audio or visual components completely disconnect, please bear with us a moment while we work to reestablish the connection as quickly as possible. If you're calling into the teleconference line for audio, you will want to mute your computer speakers so that you're not hearing the audio over your computer and telephone at the same time. Today we have three presentations given by Ann Strauss-Weeder, North Jersey Transportation Planning Authority, Stacey Hodge, New York City DOT, Allison Conway, City College of New York. Ann Strauss-Weeder is the Director of Freight Planning for the North Jersey Transportation Planning Authority. She has over 30 years of experience in supply chains and freight movement, economic analyses, and policy and project development. She works closely and collaboratively with private sector stakeholders and public sector interests to ensure that supply chain projects reflect marketing realities, emerging trends, and customer needs. She has authored numerous reports and industry assessments and is one of the co-authors of the 2014 NCFRP report, Enhancing U.S. Port Resiliency as Part of Extended Intermodal Supply Chains. Ms. Strauss-Weeder is in leadership roles in several professional organizations, including the Council of Supply Chain Management Professionals and the Transportation Research Board. She is also a member of the U.S. Department of Commerce Advisory Committee on Supply Chain Competitiveness and was a Leadership New Jersey 2010 Fellow. She has a BA and an MA in Regional Science from the University of Pennsylvania. Stacey Hodge is the Director of the Office of Freight Mobility for the New York City Department of Transportation, where she manages a multi-million dollar freight program with responsibilities for managing the city truck routes, truck delivery programs, and traffic rules and regulations that govern truck movement. Ms. Hodge coordinates the city, state, and federal agencies on transportation projects and policy. Ms. Hodge serves as the point of contact at the New York City Department of Transportation for the Volvo Center of Excellence for Sustainable Urban Freight Systems. In May 2003, Ms. Hodge was appointed to the United States Department of Transportation Secretary to serve on the National Freight Advisory Committee. In addition, Ms. Hodge is a member of the Transportation Research Board's Urban Freight Transportation Committee. Ms. Hodge has a BSCE from Florida Institute of Technology and an MSCE from Purdue University. Allison Conway is an Assistant Professor of Civil Engineering at the City College of New York and the Associate Director for Education at the Region 2 University Transportation Research Center. She is also an associate faculty member of Metro Freight at Volvo Research Education Foundation Center of Excellence in Urban Freight. She currently chairs the TRB Young Members Council and the ASCE Transportation and Development Institute's Freight and Logistics Committee and is a member of TRB's Freight Data, Truck Size and Weight, and Urban Freight Committees. Dr. Conway holds a PhD and master's degree in civil engineering from the University of Texas at Austin and a bachelor's of civil engineering from the University of Delaware. Today's seminar will last 90 minutes with 60 minutes allocated for the speakers and the final 30 minutes for audience question and answer. If during the presentations you think of a question, you can type it into the chat area. Please make sure you send your question to everyone and indicate which presenter your question is for. Presenters will be unable to answer your questions during their presentations, but I will start off the question and answer session with the questions typed into the chat box. If time allows, we will open up the phone lines for questions as well. If we run out of time and are unable to address all of the questions, we will attempt to get written responses from the presenters to the unanswered questions. PowerPoint presentations used during the seminar are available for download from the file download box in the lower right corner of your screen. The presentations will also be available online within the next few weeks, along with a recording and a transcript. I will notify all attendees once these materials are posted online. Talking Freight seminars are eligible for 1.5 certification maintenance credits for AICP members. In order to obtain credit for today's seminar, you must have logged in with your first and last name, or if you're attending with a group of people, you must type your first and last name into the chat box. I've included more detailed instructions in the file share box on how to obtain your credits after the seminar. For those of you who are not AACP members but would like to receive PDH credits for this webinar, please note that FHWA does not formally offer PDHs. However, it may be possible to receive PDHs for your participation in Talking Freight if you are able to self-certify. To possibly receive PDHs, please download the agenda from the file download box and submit this agenda to your respective licensing agency. Finally, I encourage everyone to please also download the evaluation form from the file share box and submit this form to me after you have filled it out. I'm now going to turn it over to Anne Strauss-Weeder of North Jersey Transportation Planning Authority to get us started. Anne?
Chain are used to an industry that is constantly evolving. However, the changes in last mile delivery are unprecedented, both in terms of their velocity, the speed at which these changes are occurring, and the breadth of changes that are happening. So in the next 20 minutes or so, I'm going to set the stage for the discussion by talking about what is occurring, and indeed, we're seeing it in our daily lives. Because we as consumers are the starting point, freight is a derived demand, and retail is utterly changing. On the top right is a picture of the opening of Randall Park Mall in 1976. Right below it, picture of the same mall just before its demolition about a year ago. When you think about it, we often don't go to malls these days or to brick and mortar stores. More commonly, we receive our products at our doorstep. So there is a reshaping of the characteristics of demand, what our expectations are as consumers, and that in turn is changing the facilities and the way that we receive products. So let's talk about first what's driving the changes in freight modes, the demand and our expectations. We're empowered consumers. There was a time many years ago when apples were red and peppers were green, but now we expect a great diversity of products. Not only that, but we expect all of those options to be available in stock. And if we don't find it in one place, we'll certainly find it in another place. We're informed consumers. We have the internet to search on. We have apps that can scan UPC symbols and look for the lowest price. We also want flexibility. We want to be able to go to a store to buy something we need.
We want to order it at
1 a.m. in the morning. We want items delivered to our home, perhaps to someone else's home, to our offices. We also like a flexible return policy. We want the items to be given to us in an environmentally sustainable fashion. And most importantly these days, consumers look for free shipping. Accordingly, retail channels have changed. Brick and mortar stores have been around for hundreds of years. They've also been added to by mail order catalogs and then eventually internet shopping. But it's gone beyond that now. Omnichannel refers to retailers who make use of all the channels available to them. And as I'll be discussing, the way that brick and mortar stores, internet, and mail order are being used collectively is also evolving as we speak. There's also m-commerce, which refers to use of smartphones and tablets to search for items and to order items. I do ask if you are multitasking right now and looking through Amazon that you put your phone down and listen to our presentation this afternoon. There's also social commerce, a way of influencing demand and building awareness. Pinterest, Facebook, those ads that we see when we're online, they're all designed to help build interest. And that shows our reliance on e-commerce overall. And in fact, going back to the Randall Park Mall. Since 2010, more than 24 enclosed malls have gone out of business, and over 60 now are on the brink of closing. There is an evolution that also affects development, and in that matter also affects communities. As I mentioned, it started changing when we started getting interested in free shipping, when that became the norm. Amazon Prime then raised the bar by indicating that not only are we going to get free shipping, we can pay an annual amount and get shipping within 2 days. Then the bar got raised even higher. We can get things in 1 day. And now, an even higher bar. Same day delivery if you order something online. If you're in Manhattan, as the example shows here, Barnes & Noble, they have their alliance with Google, you'll get your product same day. Same thing goes with Instacart and a variety of other options. This is not just an urban phenomenon. The implications of this transition are profound across all of the U.S. in every type of setting, whether it's rural, suburban, or urban. For example, individuals located in more remote locations, whether it's Alaska or rural locations, can now shop online and still pay $99 for their Prime service and get the lower prices and get two-day delivery. That has ramifications in terms of what they have available and potentially a lower cost, and it also has ramifications for local merchants. Some other pictures shown here, that's Amazon's 40,000 square foot fulfillment center for Prime Now, located in Manhattan, and Radio Shack, an example of what happens when a retailer cannot keep up with the rapid changes occurring. So let's talk about the last mile, how goods get to us. A completely different landscape, different in terms of point of origin, different in terms of the modes and the providers, and different even in where we receive our products. So let's walk through all of these. First of all, let's talk about origin points. And let me start with brick and mortar stores. Because their functions are changing, their locations are changing, their inventory is changing. For example, and there have been a lot of local recent press on this, Target, for example, is completely rethinking its stores and moving into urban areas with a smaller footprint. Same with Walmart. People in the D.C. area may recognize this picture of their multi-story operation in urban areas. Restoration Hardware, rethinking the store as a showcase for products. Pop-up stores, limited time demand. Stores can also be used in an omni-channel setting as a place to return products. And more recently, retailers are using those stores in a similar manner to Amazon's setting up small footprint local distribution to get to people faster. They're recognizing that their investment in brick-and-mortar stores enables them to perhaps offer that same-day demand, same-day supply, as Barnes & Noble is doing, or respond more quickly. So this is something Target is doing and Barnes & Noble is doing. Now let's move to the top one, fulfillment centers. They are a bit different than a typical distribution center. It's still a large box, but because of their function, these are buildings that may have three times the employment. A typical distribution center, which serves a variety of stores and customers, may have about 0.3 employees per 1,000 square feet. A fulfillment center typically has one employee per 1,000 square feet, and during peak periods could have as many as three employees per 1,000 square feet, which starts bringing it up to office building levels. Clearly with ramifications in terms of workforce and in terms of traffic. So let's talk about distribution center layout. Down here we have Sports Authority, and this is the Haynes Industrial Park in southern New Jersey. Very typical building, rectangular, trucks on one side, trucks on another side, moving goods through from receiving to shipping. Over here, BJ's Wholesaler, which has more of a cross-dock, very quick movement to their stores, in addition to a regular type of distribution framework. More truck trailer parking for inbound and outbound. More and more velocity going on here because of the nature of the wholesale operation. Here's an Amazon facility. Again, lots of truck parking. Again, typically 2 to 3 trailer spaces per loading dock. But more importantly, what's up front? What we see here. All that parking for all the associates working there. So again, even looking at it from a Google aerial, it's very easy to spot the fulfillment center. It's all about velocity. That's the case in distribution centers. But even more important when we're talking about fulfillment, because essentially the individuals, the associates in this building are doing our shopping for us. They're going and picking the items. It may be multi-level mezzanines where workers are picking individual items. It could be, as in the top left, Kiva robots that are bringing the racks over to the individuals. This happens in Amazon buildings. There's technology, again, for velocity and accuracy, voice to pick, shown on the bottom left, and lots of conveyors, lots of technology. If you want to see the future of transportation, go into a state-of-the-art distribution center, look at the information background, look at the technologies in place. It's all about velocity and accuracy and getting the products to us. And more importantly, it has to be done in a cost-effective manner because we have demanded that the shipping be free. So let's talk about who is providing us with items. We have established players in UPS and FedEx, but the U.S. Postal Service, an established player, is also rethinking how they use their equipment. Indeed, the U.S. Postal Service handled over 40% of Amazon's shipments. As the U.S. Postal Service is replacing their vehicles, they recognize they're going to be doing more package delivery than letters. They're not the only established players with equipment that are entering the market. For example, Gannett, a newspaper company, is looking at using their delivery products, trucks for moving products. We also have a whole variety of startups. Amazon Flex, going very Uber style, where they have independent contractors doing the deliveries. Instacart, Postmates, Deliv, a whole variety of startups, new types of businesses. If anyone has seen about curbside delivery at Target, that's not being run by Target. It's being run by a startup called Curbside, which also handles for other major retailers. It's also bringing back modes in urban settings, such as the use of freight bikes. For example, if you go to Casper Mattresses, a startup that's very successful in the mattress delivery business, they do have couriers for delivery in Manhattan, and their video will show that the box is put onto a freight bike and brought to your location. This would not be a complete discussion without considering drones. There are lots of prototypes going on in terms of how drone delivery can go into effect in rural locations and other facilities for getting packages to customers. So now let's move into how we receive products. Often they're stacked by our door. Now that can be useful if you're at home. It can be a security consideration if you're not home. If you live in a multifamily dwelling, please pity the doormat because those packages are stacking up. And in some cases, lobby space has to be redeveloped to accommodate the increased package that's being delivered. In addition, some Manhattan multifamily dwellings have had to put in refrigerators to accommodate temperature-controlled shipments for their tenants. Manage management software for multifamily buildings now enables some of the doormen to scan and let residents know when their package is in the lobby. But we're looking at a swelling of individual deliveries. And if someone is not home, if it's a missed delivery, it may be that that truck is coming multiple times, which is not necessarily cost effective and not necessarily environmentally sound as well. So what do we do when we talk about security and convenience and reducing vehicle miles traveled? We look at alternative destination points. Becoming a more familiar site are automated package lockers, APLs. Anyone ordering in Amazon can have the option of having their package delivered to their home, to another location, or pull up a screen and find out where your most local APL is available to you, which can be a Dunkin' Donuts or a convenience store or another location, perhaps in a space that used to be occupied by a newspaper stand. So we have APLs that are operated by shippers such as Amazon, DHL, UPS, FedEx, and InPost all operate them as third party. But package lockers means that you use a truck, you can bring multiple packages to a single location and go back. You're saving VMTs. In addition to package lockers, there's the option of alternative locations other than lockers where you can have your package delivered. An example is UPS Access Point, where if you're a choice customer with them, you can take a look, you can have it delivered to your home, or say have it delivered to the UPS store nearby or to a designated access point location that could be your local drugstore. UPS has also indicated they miss you at your home maybe two or three times. They may leave you a very kind note indicating your package can now be found at a certain access point. Even more high-tech, but using currently available technology, is an experiment going on in Munich, Germany, between Audi, DHL, and Amazon. In this case, if you, the customer, own an Audi and order something from Amazon and are willing to share the GPS information on your car, DHL will use tracking to find your car, a one-time code, take the package and put it in your trunk, after which the code is no longer used. So, an alternative customer location. So this is not our grandparents' last mile. This is a rapidly evolving situation that's making the news almost daily. Certainly, there are going to be additional evolutions as some of the startups go through a maturation process, and as we figure out our own purchasing patterns in the future. Certainly, this is the case in Bordentown, where an Amazon facility during peak period had so many trucks and so many associates working there that local traffic jams were caused and alternative strategies had to be developed. So, as with all types of freight, it starts with the demand, in this case, us. What's the best way of tracking what's happening? Look at what's happening with consumers. Look at how you, yourself, purchase items. We have to look at the regulatory environment, which really sets the playing field for the variety of modes that can be used, the providers, and even the types of facilities and locations that can be used for delivery. Think also about the fulfillment centers, which have a lot more associates and trucks in terms of thinking through landside and roadway requirements of communities. The supply chain is ever-evolving, and it's very exciting right now to see what is happening. And with that, thank you very much.
Thank you, Anne. We will now move on to Stacy Hodge of the New York City Department of Transportation. Stacy?
Yes, good afternoon for those on the East Coast and good morning to you on the West Coast. I will share with you today the perspective from a public agency that is experiencing an increase in population while we're also experiencing a streamlining or reduction in roadway capacity as we add other features to our network to improve quality of life, to improve bus speeds, and to accommodate additional modes of travel. This is an overview of the size of New York City, about 302 square miles with a population of 8.4 million, with an anticipation of another 1.7 million to be in the five boroughs by 2040. When we have those additional persons coming into the city, that is going to put an increased pressure on the transportation network, both for the movement of those people and for the goods and services that they will need to have provided to them, which are often provided by trucks in this urban environment. So how has our city been changing over the past few years? We've been adding additional amenities to improve the quality of life. We've added plazas, we've added bike lanes, we've added curbside bus lanes, dedicated bus lanes, because we need to improve the travel time and reliability of our transit system to move the number of people here that rely on the transit system. We've also, over the past few years, incorporated some seasonal, temporary seating spaces along corridors with a lot of restaurants. We found that this is an amenity that serves to support the economy. Locations that have had plazas, these temporary plazas installed, have seen an increase in sales. It adds more street life, and it's a better utilization of some of those spaces in that temporary seasonal time. So, overall, as we see the city changing with the accommodation for additional modes for our bike lanes to provide our residents with additional quality of life amenities such as plazas, to accommodate the bus travel and improving the bus speeds. As we look on how we must now design our streets, we must also consider how we accommodate the deliveries that are coming to these buildings and better understand the activity and the constraints of all of the modes. So one of the ways we've done that is to team with research teams as well as the private sector to better understand truck deliveries and the business needs in the city. This slide was done by a NYU, New York University, capstone team that we brought on board to help us explore the feasibility of consolidation centers. And a part of their task was to go out and interview businesses and truckers about their delivery patterns. So this sketch, it represents the truck deliveries going to one hotel in Midtown Manhattan on a given week. After we were able to show this to the hotel, they were able to figure out that they should consolidate some of their deliveries, and they also are a participant in our off-hour delivery project. So if you're working in a city and thinking about how to accommodate deliveries, one of the first things you probably need to do is go out and talk to businesses and the truckers and understand what their current truck trips and origin destination patterns are. And so that's what we've been doing with another research partner, Rensselaer Polytechnic Institute, that has developed a freight trip generation model that we have used to determine the number of truck trips going to specific parts of the city. So this map is in the Midtown, is in the Manhattan core, south of 60th Street. You will see a park at the top of this slide, that's Central Park, and we're trying to estimate how many truck trips are going to these commercial buildings because we want to approach them about coming up with more sustainable delivery practices for their buildings to reduce the congestion we're experiencing during the daytime. We also had one of our consultants summarize truck trip volumes on bridges that lead into Manhattan and found that approximately 28,000 trucks entering Manhattan on any given day. And the other reason we want to find a better way to manage these truck trips is to reduce the conflicts with our pedestrians and our cyclists. If you're going to have more deliveries coming in, we need need to find a better way to manage the conflict that will exist when you have a street like the one I'm showing in the Grand Central area with 16,000 pedestrians per hour, 900 retail stores, all of which will need deliveries, and the hotels that will need deliveries of food for their restaurants. And so our mayor has put out a plan called One NYC, and within that there is a transportation vision to get us to find a more reliable, safe, and sustainable and accessible way to move New Yorkers, meet their needs, and support the economy. So here at New York City DOT, we have several programs and strategies that we have been pursuing to accomplish that truck safety initiative. Working with the NYPD on enforcement and looking for ways that we could make enforcement more efficient using technology, potentially. Educating the public about blind spots using a program we call Truck's Eye View. Legislation, state legislation, to put crossover mirrors on trucks so that they can see the front of their vehicle to reduce fatal crashes with pedestrians. We've reduced our speed limit, and we've been exploring CCTV technology to manage trucks' movements and weigh-in motion technology. And many of you may have heard about our off-hour delivery program, which we've been doing since about 2010. We see that as a way to reduce the conflicts during the daytime between our vulnerable users and trucks. This picture shows a CCTV camera affixed to a traffic signal head. We deployed several of these near the JFK airport so that the freight team can watch what trucks were doing in that area. We used that to help us get the elected officials and the communities to allow us to have larger trucks go to the airport. Previously, we couldn't allow, it was illegal for a 53-foot trailer to travel to the JFK airport in New York City. And about a year or so ago, we were able to change that rule. And a big part of being able to change that was showing the public that we could put in this CCTV technology to monitor what trucks were doing, and then we could communicate with the police department if we saw something that shouldn't be happening. Another way to manage the truck trips are to use delivery windows. Delivery windows are basically just curb regulations that dedicate certain times of the day for trucks only for loading. And this map shows green areas and an orange area with just identifying specific times when we would have truck loading only. And that's been very effective for helping to reduce congestion on commercial corridors. But it's heavily dependent on ability to enforce. Signs are great, but if people will ignore what they say, then this corridor would not work. And that's what I'm going to show here. Another part of the city, we were approached by the residents who had a lot of double-parked delivery trucks like UPS, all of their online purchases, a lot of double-parking trucks. They asked us to put in truck loading so that there would be less double-parking trucks. And in this area where you see this white van is where we put in the truck loading. 60 feet, 1 hour limit. We found that a lot of trucks were parked or vans parked there to service this building who were not making deliveries and exceeded the 1 hour. You will see one call out there says 4 hours, 51 minutes, another for an hour, 29 minutes. You will also see in this picture two NYPD tow trucks. They tried very hard to enforce these corridors, these loading zones, but we were unable over a period of 3 months to get enough compliance, so we took away this delivery window. That was the compromise we had made with the community board, that if we took away private car parking for truck loading, it had to have worked to reduce the double parking if we wanted to keep it. So here's an image of our team out testing a mobile CCTV unit that also has a variable message sign attached to it. We have been deploying these to residential areas that have a problem with off-route trucks. And we're using that to support a city council local law that is asking us to document truck route compliance in New York City. able to log into the camera that's at the top of this sign and see what trucks are doing, what traffic is doing, and display a message such as no trucks, local or local deliveries only. Another use of technology that we've done in cooperation with the New York State DOT is we've put in a Way in Motion site on a bridge that connects New York and New Jersey. The Way in Motion scale is within that concrete slab that's being laid in this image, and that project has been in for a while now, and we're collecting very good data on the amount of overweight trucks that are coming into the city from this location. We hope to use that information to support potentially future legislation to use technology for enforcement, but we're not there yet. This is the scale once in place, so it's barely noticeable to a vehicle going over it, and it's been very, very good. The state put in license plate readers, so we're actually able to identify the actual trucks that are overweight. This is the off-hour delivery program, and this is a hotel in the Times Square area within walking distance to the Port Authority bus terminal, which means there's a lot of activity and traffic in this area. You have a lot of pedestrians because it's also close to the theater district. And if you were a truck driver needing to deliver food to this hotel, you would find it very difficult to find access to this curb. So this hotel on this block was one of our off-hour delivery participants, and this is what that street looks like at 4:05 in the morning. So now you can make your delivery, not have any conflicts with pedestrians, have a shorter, less complicated route into the hotel, because during the day they would not let a driver walk into the front of this hotel carrying products like he is in this image. GPS devices used on our off-hour delivery participants were able to compare how long it took to make a delivery during the day and how long it took them during the night. A delivery such as this could take 2.5 hours during the daytime, and it was reduced to about 20 minutes in the off-hour. So our mayor is supporting off-hour deliveries. We've been asked to expand this program, scale it up. There are over 9,000 restaurants and drinking places in Manhattan, all of which need trip deliveries. And we're continuing to work with our partners, our academic partners, our public agency partners, and industry to expand this program. We're currently working with the Department of Education to see if we can switch some of the schools that they deliver food to their vendors to go into the off-hour. That is under development. We also have our New York City truck route map, which last year our IT team was able to make a more user-friendly tool for your smartphone. So if you can go to this website, you can download our truck map now to your iPad or smartphone, which is much more user-friendly because we want to make it easier for the drivers to find their way legally to and from their destinations. Another area we would strongly encourage you, if you're working on urban freight in your cities, is to think about truck routes and land uses and how you can plan those to reduce conflicts. In this picture, you will see yellow lots. Those are residential, and the purple lots are manufacturing. The blue lines that you see in the drawing represent truck routes. Unfortunately, at the time that this was designed, many of these truck routes were very close to these residential lots. And a lot of trucks traverse the residential area in order to get to the manufacturing centers. The community asked us to remove the truck routes that were predominantly surrounded by residential lots and make the truck routes that were more completely surrounded by industrial lots to be the primary way into this neighborhood. And so we have since done that and removed the sections of the truck route, Fresh Pond Road, sections of Flushing and Grand, and prioritized the truck route for access to the industrial area more on the end of Maurice and 58. Why is that important? Because if you don't do that, you end up with problems like this, where you've got manufacturing industrial sites across the street from residential areas and large trucks trying to make their delivery at those locations, creating a lot of chaos for the residents and getting a lot of phone calls to us here at DOT. Lastly, and I'm going to close with this, another program that we are doing here at New York City, and it's run by another unit, not my team, but the alternative fuel team, is trying to get fleets to be greener and reduce less quality, air quality impact. So one of the programs that they have done that recently reached a 500 truck retrofit milestone is the Hunts Point Clean Fuels Program. This image shows the yellow and red triangles that you see are actually the GPS location of the trucks that were in this program. Any company that was given funding to retrofit their truck to a more clean fuel type truck had to prove that they were actually using the truck in the Hunts Point Bronx area and using it within the tri-state area. To do that, we needed to have access to their AVL, their automated vehicle location device, or GPS, and then a contractor that was hired to work with the alternative fuels team managed all of that data to document the compliance with that stipulation. The yellow and red just identify a different time of day that the truck was in operation. And so when I say the tri-state area, that's the Connecticut, New Jersey, New York area, but some of these trucks even went down into the Pennsylvania area and maybe even further up into Massachusetts. So this image is an illustration of the GPS data for 343 trucks that operated between 8 a.m. and 3:59 a.m. and where they went. So by putting funding into a clean fuels truck program for the Bronx, we were actually adding clean fuel benefits to a much wider region. Last year, we had a press event to celebrate the 500th truck milestone for that program, and we had Peter Osborne from Federal Highway come down and present and give some words of encouragement to the team and the industry who was there. And this is just a quick overview. If you were in the program, you had to commit for 5 years. You had to provide your GPS information so we could prove that 70% of your VMT was in our tri-state area and that you actually made an average of 2 trips to the Bronx per week. And I think that is the end of my presentation, an overview of the various initiatives that we are doing here at New York City DOT to try to balance the needs of our residents, the needs of industry, and the need to be able to move people and goods safely. Thank you, Nicole.
Thank you, Stacy. We're now going to move on to Allison Conway of City College of New York. Allison?
Researchers at RPI and Stacy have found to provide inadequate
crisis, particularly as part of one of the mayor's major initiatives, which is to develop affordable housing. So we have dense residential developments coming up all over the city, which, as Ann pointed out, are now actually major generators of freight activity as we're in the midst of this e-commerce boom. At the same time that freight is becoming, that the demand is increasing and the spatial and temporal distribution of that demand is changing because of these new residential generators, we're also dealing with the shrinking urban street capacity. And Stacy's already detailed this in great detail in terms of the bike network, the bus installations, and pedestrian-friendly treatments that have been installed. So what do these things actually mean for the city? As capacity on the urban street network begins to disappear for these other, you know, well-intentioned uses, what happens to the freight network? In terms of big picture impacts, it reduces lane capacity, particularly at intersections where we're trying to shorten pedestrian crossing distances. We end up with limited turning radii that might be difficult to navigate for trucks. As Stacy mentioned, when we have a designated local truck route network, when changes happen, such as one direction of movement being taken away on that truck network, it can actually either drive trucks onto streets where they're not supposed to be operating or require them to travel far out of their way to stay legally on the truck network. The installation of bicycle and dedicated bus installations at the curbside can reduce parking capacity, so whether that's putting in a curbside bus lane or bike lane or having intersection mixing zones that consume the capacity, parking capacity is lost. And ultimately, curb access might completely disappear. Why do we care about these things? Because as these things happen, we see increases in congestion and idling of trucks on the network. We have more double parking, and we have an increased mileage of truck trips that are actually happening on the network. Why do we care about those things? Ultimately, what those translate to are greater emissions, more congestion, increased exposure to accidents. So the larger or the longer distance that heavy vehicles are traveling on the network, that's more exposure that other vehicles on the network are going to have to those vehicles. Particularly when those trucks leave the designated truck network and are traveling on routes that were not built for them, they can cause significant infrastructure damage. And ultimately for industry, it's going to end up coming back to costs such as, you know, wasted fuel, increased driver time, and other associated costs. So the goal of this project, this was an exploratory analysis, recognizing that the detailed freight operational data at the disaggregate level is not very much. So what we wanted to do was take data sets that were not necessarily collected with the intent of studying freight operations and see what we could find out about the way that the network is changing and particularly about the way that trucks and bicycles are interacting on the network. And so we did that by essentially mapping and visualization and some very basic statistical analysis to see what we could find. Our analysis looked at three separate issues. The first was the extent to which the truck routes have actually been impacted by growth of the bicycle network. The second is where are accidents now happening, both on the truck route network and involving commercial vehicles overall. And then finally, where are there parking conflicts where there's actually bicycle infrastructure and trucks trying happening in places where enforcement's not happening. So, again, starting from these data sets, there were a number of questions that we attempted to look at. The first, again, is the extent to which the networks overlap. So how much of the truck route network is now on the same right-of-way as the bicycle network? And then not just quantifying the mileage, but looking at what types of bicycle infrastructure are actually being installed on the truck
different commuter population that's going to be using the same route. So here we see an example of a street that's not very wide. It has a designated bike lane, but it's a very narrow street for the amount of volume that it carries, and we can see that there's a heavy concentration of collisions. Last thing I want to point out on this graphic is just that when you look at downtown Brooklyn, what you can see is even those trucks, collisions that are not happening on the truck route network are happening very close to the truck route network. These accidents are actually happening within a block or two of the truck route network. What this suggests to me, at least looking at this, is that these collisions are not occurring where trucks are going rogue and going off of where they're supposed to be, but they're actually most likely happening during the truck operating under its proper legal guidelines, moving to those locations close off of the network. Okay, so the second thing I wanted to point out with these mapping of the accidents is that not just focusing in on commercial vehicles, but looking at overall bicycle accidents. A highly disproportionate share of the collisions that are occurring anywhere on-street bike lanes are concentrated on the truck route network. So of the limited network that we used for our analysis, we had about 363 lanes of bike lanes, only about 20% of which were this truck route overlap. However, more than half of all bicycle accidents that occurred in the network occurred on those routes, and close to two-thirds of all CV-involved accidents occurred on those routes. Again, that's where the trucks are operating, so that's where we would expect these collisions to happen, but I think this raises a question as to, yes, there are going to be volume impacts. Those are heavy volume routes that are carrying a lot of vehicles and a lot of bikes, so we expect higher accident shares, but if there is such a heavy concentration on these shared routes, that may be an indicator that we need to look a little bit more carefully at whether those actually should be shared routes. And that brings to my second point on the slide, which is that in addition to being heavily concentrated on truck routes, we also found that a disproportionate share of accidents are happening in these protected bike lanes, which is completely counterintuitive. We would expect that the protected paths are providing more protection so that fewer collisions are happening. Again, there's probably a volume impact that we haven't been able to control for because we do not have the local truck and bicycle route volumes. However, there may also be some specific challenges. For example, right-turning vehicles crossing a protected lane may have visibility problems that may cause these problems. So definitely there's further research needed here. Last thing we wanted to look at with the accidents was just to see how closely the accident locations were related to demand. Again, this was a very basic analysis because of the way that we needed to code the data. Essentially, we had to, for each accident type that we wanted to look at, we had large CV-involved accidents and small CV-involved accidents. We took the entire data set, separated out the accidents involving those vehicles, and then we used those two data sets to compare the characteristics of the locations where the accidents involving CVs occurred and the areas where accidents not involving CVs occurred. And so what we found was not at all shocking is that the expected freight demand factors are higher in the locations where the CV accidents are happening. For large CVs, there was a significant relationship with wholesale, retail, and transportation and warehousing employment. For small CVs, we saw areas with high population density where all those e-commerce deliveries are happening, areas where we have a lot of manufacturing, and areas where we've got transportation and warehousing. So, last segment of our analysis was zeroing in on these parking violations. So, in terms of the parking violations, we mapped them to the nearest block. We found 23 blocks citywide for the three-month analysis period that we used, where more than 20 violations occurred in a single block for a commercial vehicle parked in a bicycle lane. Not surprisingly, the lane types that seemed to be most problematic were these standard lanes, which would be, you know, next to parking and between parking and a travel lane. Something that surprised us a little bit, though, was that these critical locations were not concentrated along commercial corridors where we might have expected them, but rather were distributed throughout four boroughs. There were none in Staten Island, primarily because there's very little bicycle network in Staten Island. But they also were
made when they had to park in these locations. And the first thing we noticed was that there was very different availability on the three locations. In East Broadway, more than half of the commercial vehicles arriving actually had access to parking directly at their delivery location. That's because East Broadway is regulated as a commercial metered street, so there's heavy, fast turnover due to the metering, and it's designated for commercial parking. The Grand Concourse is metered, but not designated for commercial vehicles. West 77th Street is residential, meaning that it's residential parking, and in New York City, residential parking means essentially that drivers move their car twice a week for street cleaning, and for the rest of the week, those vehicles turn over at a very slow rate. What we can see from the colored graph on the right is that these almost directly are proportional to the choices that drivers actually make. When they have access to legal parking directly in front of their location, most of the time they're going to use it. However, you can also see from this graph that they are not necessarily always going to use that parking. So the second thing we wanted to look at was breaking down these vehicles by sector. How did their choices look different? So first, just in terms of availability, more than two-thirds of food and beverage delivery vehicles, because I guess of the locations where they were delivering to, actually had access to legal parking either directly in front of their delivery location or elsewhere on the block. Parcel trucks, many of which were delivering to residential locations, had a much lower access to legal parking. So only about a third of these parcel trucks actually had access to legal parking anywhere on the block to which they were delivering. Now, even where the parking was available, the use of it was also different. So moving trucks and service trucks, if there's legal parking available, they almost always are using it. However, for these parcel vehicles, even when a legal parking spot was open right in front of the location, the truck still chose not to use it more than half the time. Same thing for legal parking on the block. When we looked at the block level, essentially the service vehicles were willing to park down the block. Now, those service vehicles are things like utility trucks and plumbers and people who have a commercial tag but are not necessarily moving goods. It makes sense that they would be able to use the whole block for parking. The parcel trucks almost never will use that parking elsewhere on the block, and food and beverage trucks less than half the time used it as well. Why? Because the types of deliveries that are actually being made will vary and the duration for which they're parking. Those food and beverage and parcel deliveries are very heavily concentrated in these very short trips. So 0 to 10 minute parking is how long the vast majority of those vehicle types are parking. So those drivers are not going to go out of their way to spend extra time parking when they're making a very fast delivery. At the other end, we've got those service and moving trucks that are willing to that are required to park for a much longer time, and again, those are the ones that are going to be more willing to look for that more distant parking. So, overall, just to review the key observations that we found from this exploratory analysis, we found that 55 miles of centerline miles of bike lanes have been installed on the truck route network since 2000. We found that bicycle collisions are disproportionately concentrated on the truck routes and in protected lanes. We found that commercial vehicles frequently in all three of these locations we observed, they essentially had the choice to obstruct a single travel lane or to park illegally in the bike lane, and in many cases they chose to do so. And finally, the parking availability and choices varied considerably by location and sector. One other point that Stacy mentioned that I do want to mention here is that enforcement also makes a difference, or in fact doesn't make a difference, for some of these driver types. And so, for example, many of the parcel trucks we saw were essentially, even if they got a ticket, they barely looked up as they got the ticket. So enforcement is an important part of this, but enforcement is also not one size fits all. So learning from this exploratory analysis, there's a lot of future research we need to do, including looking at what the actual congestion and emissions impacts from these reduced capacities are,